The exhibition Sacred Sisters is a collaboration between award-winning artist Holly Trossel Brigham and distinguished poet Marilyn Nelson at the Sordoni Art Gallery at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre through March 1st. Joanne Reif, art historian and musicologist from Scranton and past chair of the VIA Community Advisory Board, takes us into the special space created by these mostly watercolor portraits in their conversation with each other and us.
Entering the Sordoni Gallery to view Holly Trossel Brigham's Sacred Sisters, I was struck by the openness of the space. It was as if I were entering a sacred space. Each picture is hung a distance from the next, as if each sister were in her own room, or, in the language of the cloister, her own cell. In this space of her own, sacred to her and to the vows she has taken, in this private space, her talent grew, whether as mystic or visionary, as painter, poet, or musician, or as teacher and healer of the forgotten. We traverse 8 centuries, from the 12th to the 19th, guided by the artist and by the poems of Marilyn Nelson that are displayed beside each painting. A golden tone pervades the gallery from picture to picture and across the room, as if each person were connected by the radiance of their minds and talents. What appears as golden streams of light in the veil of one sister may appear in the golden white habit of another. The golden braided hair of one may be reflected in the medallions of another. We are greeted by the most famous 12th century abbess, Hildegard of Bingen, a visionary and mystic who composed poetry and music, wrote treatises in theology as well as medicine, who corresponded with popes and was sought out by the Holy Roman Emperor for her diplomatic advice. Hildegard, in her portrait in the Sordoni, oversees the room. Her face is lifted and looking upwards, the expression rapt. Her eyes look to the side a little warily, but intent on listening. With the look in her eyes and her head slightly tilted, it is as if she is looking through the sound, as if she is listening for something that will be told to her. It will come to her in vision and in sound. A golden jeweled nimbus surrounds Hildegard's head, narrow lines of gold streaming through her black veil. Her hands, which are broad but delicate, show a golden brown tint and lie lightly across her breast in an attitude of prayer. Her face fills the picture space almost as if her life and her endeavors exceed the space allotted them. This dazzling picture is placed atop a box, the only installation piece of the exhibition. The box is painted in a jewel-like lapis blue and decorated with a golden vine motif around its border. The door of the box faces the viewer and makes the box look like a tabernacle, just opened to reveal the holy objects stored inside. They come as a surprise to the viewer, a wax heart and a tongue, each hanging in its own filigree pouch, as if they were relics. The interior suggests the soul. The exterior records episodes from the saint's life. Of the 3 panels, the one depicting the young Hildegard caught my eye. A girl dressed in a white robe and holding a lighted candle approaches the round window of a stone, medieval-looking room. An older sister, a nun, following her with hand placed on the girl's shoulder and guiding her toward the window as if in procession. A dove flies in toward the girl in a flood of light through the window to the young one's candle. Immediately, Hildegard's sequence, Columba Aspexit, came to mind. Columba Aspexit per Cancelos Fenestre. The dove entered through the lattices of the window, where, before its face, balm emanated. The heat of the sun burned and dazzled into the gloom, whence a jewel sprang forth in the building of the temple of the most pure, loving heart. Hildegard and the Hildegard portrait and box set the tone for the entire exhibition. Indeed, her music is to be played when the exhibition is open. Another musician appears on the far wall, Santa Caterina of Bologna, not only a musician, but painter and illuminator of manuscripts as well, a formidable woman living in a rich world. As a girl, in the mid-15th century, she lived at the court of the Este family in Ferrara. But Holly Brigham paints her in an even richer world. The saint is presented in the left foreground of the picture. Behind her and to the right, a rich golden brocaded fabric appliqued to the canvas. We might see it now in this cold weather as a drapery to keep our sacred sister warm. Behind her to the left and peering out over her shoulder are a Madonna and Child, a painting long attributed to her. On a table to the right is a manuscript, a reference to her breviary that she copied and illuminated in rich unseals. Most interesting is the odd musical instrument that she is playing and has standing upright on the table. It is her violetta and can still be seen in the Cathedral of Bologna. It is a bowed instrument with four strings, round in outline like a viol, flat in surface, with a box superimposed at the middle of the instrument that resembles a squared guitar. To see this instrument itself is worth a visit to the exhibition. Striking in the picture is how large Santa Caterina's hands are. She, too, is intent on listening and holds her head down and to the side, bypassing the gaze of the viewer. In Sorella Plautilla Nelli, we see the daughter of a rich Florentine family of the 16th century who sought out a Dominican convent in Florence where the sisters dedicated themselves to painting. Also radiant like her sacred sisters of the exhibition, she is pictured in golden light that extends from a crucifix above and behind her left shoulder to the head of a small child leaning in toward her side, a reference perhaps to Sorella Plautilla's Madonna and Child with four angels. Brush poised in her right hand, she looks ahead and to the side of the canvas that we assume is in front of her. Toward the back of the gallery, two very different sisters draw our attention. Both lived in the mid-19th century and come from very different worlds. Henriette Delisle, a New Orleans woman of mixed race, is pictured in a very simple habit, a black schoolteacher's dress with white collar and cuffs. Most likely indoors at her convent, she wears no head covering and is shown sewing a black doll of the baby Jesus. She is a sacred sister as artist and as social conscience of the world around her. Otagaki Rengetsu is a Buddhist nun, also of the mid-19th century, who sought the convent because of her illegitimate birth. She kneels, turned slightly forward, in the foreground of her austere room, in simple kimono and shaved head, presenting her drawing to us with her left hand. Her work is not finished. Calligrapher's brush in her right hand, she sets it to paper to continue. One painting that is different from any other in the exhibition that strikes the viewer immediately and that is menacing in its aspect is that of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, a 17th century Mexican daughter of a native mother and a Spanish father. She is remembered by us mainly as a poet. She was another Hildegard in the range of her intellect and knowledge, but to her misfortune and ours was born in a very different time and place. The faces of the sacred sisters at times may look intent or pensive or determined, but this is the face of a man. This is a set face that looks like a mask. It is surrounded by a veil that looks like the wig of an English chief justice. There is writing on the painting as well, as in 17th century paintings, and a very heavy, imposing black and gold frame. Yet, very curiously, a bouquet of flowers, so colorful, emanates from this sister's head. This is the only picture in which the sister looks directly at the viewer. It is hard to know whose face this is. It is truly as if we look through a mirror darkly, or as if the sitter herself did. Sor Juana was the most gifted woman of her age. She amassed a library and a collection of musical and scientific instruments. In the locutory of her convent, the important people of her day came for her advice and her brilliant conversation. She enjoyed the patronage of the Vice-Ren of Mexico, who made sure that Sor Juana's work was disseminated in Spain and its possessions. Yet, after the Vice-Ren left Mexico, Sor Juana fell like prey into the hands of her confessor. She was not humble. She was filled with the vanities of the world, he complained. She must hand over her library and collections to the archbishop, and she must help the poor and nurse the sick like the rest of her sisters. 2 years later, she died of the very plague she was nursing. The text that is quoted on Holly Brigham's most penetrating painting of Sor Juana begins, "Este que ves, engaño colorido que del arte ostentando." In translation, "These lying pigments facing you with every charm brush can supply set up false premises of color to lead astray the unwary eye. Here, against ghastly toils of time, bland flattery has staked a claim, defying the power of passing years to wipe out memory and name. And here, in this hollow artifice, frail blossom hanging on the wind, vain pleading in a foolish cause, poor shield against what fate has wrought. All efforts fail, and in the end, a body goes to dust, to shade, to naught." The painting gives us pause as our eye sweeps the gallery for a last time, and we are about to leave. Sor Juana, to my mind, is the crowning painting of the exhibition, so gorgeous in materials and so stunning in meaning. I urge you to see it. Holly Trossel Brigham has presented 8 portraits, and what I have left for last to say is that each one is a portrait of her. This accounts in part for the unusual gaze of each sitter, since an artist painting a self-portrait does so by looking in a mirror. These 8 sitters cast their gaze in many directions, to earth and heavens, to imagined places and times, to the images, the poetry, and music that surround them, and that they wish so earnestly to find and to unlock. With each sister, a self-portrait, what is the artist telling us about all the things she has portrayed? Are all these talents within her and within all of us who are sisters to each other in our thoughts and in our works? Only a visit to the Sordoni will cast light on an answer.
Dr. Joanne Reif, art historian and musicologist from Scranton, taking us into the special surround created by the exhibition Sacred Sisters, a collaboration between award-winning artist Holly Trossel Brigham and distinguished poet Marilyn Nelson at the Sordoni Art Gallery at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre through March 1st. Dr. Reif leaves us with a question about the way the portraits question us as viewers. We continue our conversation with Holly Trussell Brigham and Heatherson Cavage, director of the Sordoni Gallery, about these powerful pieces and Holly's work with self-portraits.
It's important for me that people know that I'm a woman artist, so I think that's part of it. I also think as soon as you were talking about that, I remember very vividly I spent my junior year abroad from Smith College in Florence, Italy. And when you look at the Ghiberti doors on the Duomo, and, you know, he has his own self-portrait right there. I mean, it's one of the first things you learn in art history. And so, you know, the male artist saying, here I am, I created all of this. So, you know, that has something to do with it. I have done self-portraiture for years, and that kind of stems back to when I was getting ready to go to graduate school and needed to get a portfolio together. And I actually had a bunch of images of my paintings, and I sent them to my Smith College professor, Nicholas von Buidos, who had taught me painting and other studio art classes. And I said, you know, I need your read on these images. You know, which one should I put? Which 20 should I choose for my portfolio to get into an MFA program? And he said, well, the you know, they're all good, but the ones I really like are the self-portraits. And he said, there's a psychology that you get to them. It's very kind of intense and interesting, multi-layered. And I think you should explore that a little bit more. So I obviously am still exploring it all these years later.
These figures in your paintings are flesh and blood. This is incarnation, right?
Well, I think it's interesting that you put it that way. My idea of, you know, so there's that connection to using myself. But, you know, when you do a portrait, it's always good to work from life. Well, I'm painting historical figures, and the historical figures are no longer living. So, you know, I read about their biography, and, you know, sometimes you can't find much on these women, these obscure subject matter. But I read what I can. I sort of learn about their story. And then I kind of like think about that as I'm painting myself. So there is, I'm trying for a mood or an emotion, a moment. I'm trying to make it as if you've just walked in on these nuns at work. Oftentimes they're working. I want to show them creating in my painting because I think that's important to show them, you know, being active and doing, you know, showing their creativity. But it also leads me to something else that we should talk about. And that is that this collaboration with Marilyn Nelson, when we had that dinner, we went to an Indian restaurant on the main line in Philadelphia. And one of the first things she said to me was, well, have you identified all the nuns? Do you know all the nuns that you're painting? And I said, well, I know a few that I want to include. I want to do Sor Juana. I really think that she's important. She's kind of labeled the first feminist. I really, you know, am interested in her. And I said, and she's perfect now because I'm working with you, who's a poet, and she was a poet. So that makes a lot of sense. But I said, I like to kind of leave it open-ended. So I'm working. I have a few empty spots or whatever, and in case I come across something. And she said, well, I was wondering if you've ever thought of, you know, maybe doing a Buddhist nun. And I said, wow. I said, well, I haven't. And I said, I'm not sure I could use myself as the model. And she said, well, let's think about that, you know. And she had a couple ideas of other subject matter. She said, there's a historical figure named Henrietta DeLille. And she lived in New Orleans in the middle of the 19th century, and she actually founded the first order for African-American nuns. And I said, wow, that's fascinating. So, of course, I was taking notes. And, you know, she said, so I want you to just kind of think about this and go back and research it and figure out if this is something you would be interested in. So I did, but I had to kind of figure out if I'm going to do a Buddhist nun, I need to find a historical figure who was an artist. And so I called up the Worcester Art Museum and talked to Louise Virgin, who was the curator of Asian art, because my husband and I had been up in Worcester, Massachusetts before I was working on this series. And she's actually a Smithy as well. And she said, well, you should look up Otagaki Rengetsu, who was an amazing ceramicist, and she was a Buddhist nun. And I said, you're kidding. And so then I started to look at, and I said, well, that's perfect. That's who my subject is. Except, you know, she's Japanese. She lived at the end of the 18th into the early 19th century. How could I possibly paint myself as a Buddhist, a Japanese Buddhist nun? So I talked to Marilyn about this. It came up a number of times because Henrietta DeLille was Creole. And so she was of, you know, mixed race, and there's only one photograph in existence. I mean, there may be other ones, but they haven't been identified yet. And the photograph of Henrietta DeLille showed a woman who actually kind of resembled me. So I thought, I can be that. I can, you know, I can paint her and use myself as the model. But then we went on to Marilyn really wanted us to deal with the order of the Sisterhood of the Good Death, which is in Brazil. And there is an order, and they were founded also in the 19th century, and it was an order of nuns who basically came into existence because they're from African heritage. They wanted to raise money to free other slaves. And so I, of course, was really excited. Sisterhood of the Good Death. I mean, that isn't that fabulous? So I started looking at some images and researching that, and I really wanted to do that. But once again, how could I use myself as a model? You know, I'm white. I could not possibly do that. It would not be politically correct. I could not do it and feel comfortable about it. Marilyn wanted me to try to explore that. She used to teach at the University of Connecticut. And she said that she knew from years ago there was a computer program where you could actually put your photograph into it and you could make yourself look like another race. And she said, maybe look into that. Maybe that's something you could do. So I thought about that, and I just, in my gut, I just could not kind of get my head around it. And so for Otagaki Rengetsu, there's a artist in Philadelphia who went to the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, and I had her pose for me, so she is Otagaki. And then actually my next-door neighbor is African-American. She teaches marketing at Temple. She's a friend. She went to University of Pennsylvania. She's just really striking and amazing. And I asked her if she would pose for me to be my Sister of the Good Death. And so she is Hilaria. She's one of the nuns.
You have to tell us what the significance of being a Sister of the Good Death is.
Well, yes, thank you. That's a great question, too. So the Sisterhood of the Good Death, so you know now that they were founded to free slaves. So what they did was they inverted the whole source. The slaves were picking tobacco leaves in Brazil. And so they took that. They decided to make cigars, and they sold the cigars, and they raised enough money to free a slave, and then they would do it again, and they would free another slave. So it's just amazing. I mean, it's just an amazing, amazing story. And so what they decided, what part of their order is for the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, which is usually around August 18th, and it varies a little bit day to day, year to year, but there are 3 days, and that's sort of like their big celebration every year. So on the first day, they have a sculpture of the Virgin Mary, and they parade her through the village. And then on the second day, they go through the ritual of her death. And so they lay her out in their church, and they have candles, and they have lots of chrysanthemum flowers, and the nuns mourn her death. And then on the third day, they celebrate her assumption into heaven. So they have a big street festival, which is, you know, lots of samba dancing. And actually the figure Hilaria, she's kind of credited with being one of the founders of samba dance. So not only was she a nun, I mean, this is from Marilyn. You know, Marilyn figured all this out. And so in the painting, we have Laron Anderson Bell, my next door neighbor, who is posing as Hilaria. And I was able to work myself into this painting. I also worked myself into Rengetsu, so I'll tell you about that too. But in the background of Hilaria is the Madonna sculpture laid out on her deathbed. And so that's me. I am this in the Virgin Mary. I'm the statue of the Virgin Mary. So I'm there. So I didn't give up complete. So I'm there. And then with Rengetsu, this is probably taking a major artistic license, but I put a theater mask on the back wall of Rengetsu's Buddhist room, and that's me. It's my head.
Heather, you've seen them. You know, Holly, what makes these so vibrant and alive? These are not static.
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, these are on a human scale. And when you're faced with them in the gallery, you can practically feel like you're having this conversation. And then if you go a little bit further, if you really investigate them, there's a lot of really energetic mark making throughout the surfaces of facial features and the amazing like fabrics that they're wearing and whatnot. So it's very much vibrating with energy.
What is evoked, or is there an evocation in these works of traditional religious iconography and ways of your
mark making?
Yes.
Well, that's something, I mean, it's really great that Heather said that and started talking about that, because it's something that I think about more every year. Because so the paintings are in watercolor, and I work between wash and linear work. But I think what's becoming more prevalent as my work sort of develops over the years is the line making. I'm using, you know, 000 brushes. If any of you are out there painters, you know, I mean, it's basically like a pencil point. It's very, very small. I go through a lot of them because I'm making a lot of lines. They don't last very long. And it all harkens back to my graduate school days, I believe. I went to George Washington University and received my MFA in painting. And my mentor, my thesis advisor, my favorite instructor and professor at George Washington University was a man named Arthur Hall Smith. And Arthur Hall Smith was in the first Fulbright class and went to Japan. And his painting technique, he studied with Mark Tobey, but his painting technique was to basically use ink and black acrylic paint and to do a lot of line marking, and to treat realistic subject matter was what he taught us, but to use this like line marking. And he invented something that's called a brutalized line. I mean, when I've taught college students and, you know, my own private students and things, I will teach them that if we do the Sumi ink technique. It's kind of part painting, part drawing. And that's kind of what I'm doing with my watercolors. And it's very meditative in the line making. And I think the more I do it, the more you kind of get into a zone. It's almost like relaxing in a way. And there's this push-pull between the wash work and the linear work. And it's like you keep kind of going until you feel like it's like a perfect marriage of the two. So Arthur Hall Smith's work as a mature artist was abstract. And so he would do planar shapes. And so if you can just stay with me for a minute, imagine a square. You've made a square in ink. So the ink is wet. You've made it with a quill pen. And then you can take a very stiff, old, nasty brush and you fray the line. So if you have a square and you push the line outward all around, the square will float forward because it's white and it's kind of shaded around. Now, if you take a square and you do the ink line and you brutalize it, the term brutalize, if you brutalize it inward, then you have a square that recedes in space. So those principles are things that I apply when I'm painting in watercolor. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily brutalizing, but it's the line making and it's this marriage of the wash and the linear work.
You've used the word feminist artist, making sure that these women have a voice and can be heard and seen. Does that open up this way or broaden the images that we might have in the Western tradition of a male-centric god? Does this make some space for the feminine in that way?
Well, I think that's an important question. I think it's something that perhaps I've dealt with before, where I sort of went from doing mythological imagery to historical imagery. So I was painting goddesses and sort of thinking about reclaiming an earlier time where women were perhaps more revered. So, I mean, it's something that I think about. I just want to get, you know, my original mindset in painting life-size figures, painting women and painting them in strong poses, which was sort of the initial idea when I was in graduate school, was to kind of counterbalance all the objectified negative imagery of women that I was seeing in art history and seeing in museums and galleries. And so, I mean, I will continue to probably paint this way for the rest of my life, and I probably will still not be able to counterbalance all the negative imagery of women that's out there. But it's my goal to do that and to try to, you know, now that I'm doing historical figures, so it was historical women artists first, then historical religious women who were artists or writers. So just trying to change the canon a bit and try to educate people and let people know that there are all these really creative, wonderful women out there that they should know about.
Heather, tell us how we can see this and what kinds of things you might have connected event-wise.
Yeah, of course. We are open from Tuesday through Sunday. Our hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10 to 5, Thursdays 10 to 7, and Saturday and Sunday from 12 to 5. This is part of two exhibitions we have on view at the Sordoni. The other exhibition is The Peasant War by Katha Kollwitz. And hopefully you come by to see both, because these are two very strong women artists that we're representing, as well as strong women poets. We do also have, for the first time ever, a makerspace. Being that both exhibitions are really tied to poetry, we are really exploring that in the back in an experimental way. So you can try out our haiku wall. You can sit in our reading nook and read from our Manuscript Society journals dating back to the 70s. And I guess that would be a good plug for our upcoming Visible Poetry Project and poetry reading from the Manuscript Society happening on February 20th at 5 p.m.
Heather Sienkiewicz, director of the Sordoni Art Gallery, and award-winning artist Holly Trossel Brigham of Philadelphia, speaking with us about the exhibition Sacred Sisters, a collaboration between Holly Trossel Brigham and award-winning poet, Guggenheim Fellow, and former Connecticut Poet Laureate Marilyn Nelson. The exhibition will run at the Sordoni Art Gallery at Wilkes University to March 1st. For more information, on the web, wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery, S-O-R-D-O-N-I, Sordoni Art Gallery. The gallery is located at 141 South Main Street in Wilkes-Barre. And again, the exhibition Sacred Sisters at the gallery to March 1st. For more information, wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery.